Salon at 615 presents best-selling authors free to the public through a unique partnership between Nashville Public Library, Humanities Tennessee, Parnassus Books, and the Nashville Public Library Foundation. This Salon at 615 was recorded live at the Nashville Public Library.
Thank y'all so much. I am so, so happy to be here, and I think I probably know almost every single person in the room, and I could just thank you individually for coming or just do a collective thank you, but I really want to thank Parnassus and Ann and Karen for helping us get this together, and thanking Elise and everybody at the Downtown Public Library. A huge thank you to Wendy, who first had coffee with me, and I talked to her about the idea of snake oil and wanting to do this book, and she came and sat in the Thistle Farm Circle and said she would love to work on a manuscript, and then Chelsea and Lainey and everybody from Jericho Books and Hachette have been wonderful in making this happen. I love the cover. I love the way it's laid out. I love all the details of it, and just also how beautifully committed they are to the projects of Magdalene Thistle Farms along the way. It's hard when you work with an author, but when you work with an author who's bringing usually 40 or 50 people along for the journey, it becomes even more stressful sometimes. So that is huge. Meredith and Dan from Creative Trust are the first people I took the idea, and they helped me develop it, and I'm grateful to both of them. And there are so many people from Magdalene Thistle Farms, I don't even know where to start. I dedicated the book to the original board who made the dream of a sanctuary a reality for me. And I mean that with all my heart. And Marley and Carol and Carrie and Sandy and Allie and Tara and Dorinda and Kay and everybody who's been sitting in that circle, Katrina and Shell, who have helped lead that team so beautifully, and everybody over there. And I have had the same home altar for a little bit over 17 years now. And that community of St. Augustine's has been the place of freedom for me to be able to speak my truth and to preach about inclusiveness and love in a way that I don't know that I could everywhere else. And so to the board and Mary and Don and Lissa and Susan and Deb and Kay and Andrew and Peggy and everybody at St. Augustine's, I love y'all crazy. To my husband, Marcus, Levi, Kaney, and Moses, our three kids, I'm so grateful to them. They didn't really help me a lot, but they actually unhelped me a lot. But I still feel like I should thank them at some level. And above all, I want to thank Tim Fudge, who has been with me the whole way. He was critical about my grammar and helped me type in sections, and he researched some stuff that we needed research on, and he's been on the road with me for the last few years and has really made a difference. So Tim, I love you. Thank you, thank you, thank you. All right, so what the heck is a snake oil? That's the first question you get when you write a book called Snake Oil. And so I thought the first passage I should read would just really define what I'm thinking about when I'm saying snake oil, besides the fact that I think it's an amazing title. So I said the word snake oil the first time when I was in Chicago speaking to a group of people who were eating salad, and I said, basically at Thistle Farms, we take your salad dressing and turn it into healing products. I'm kind of like a snake oil salesman. So I started to think about what that was when I got back to my room. Sometimes a passing thought seems to come from nowhere, but upon reflection provides a spark of insight on an idea that has been germinating for years. I knew I wasn't the stereotypical portrait of a snake oil salesman selling mixtures out of a dilapidated cart at a state fair. I'm a more modern, social justice-driven version. I select time-tested homemade concoctions and tonics, mix them into an enterprise to help women, and market them as central to healing work that incorporates the body, mind, and spirit. The phrase actually suits me. For thousands of years, healers have handed down the ability to use oils properly. The name derives from the traveling shows out west in the 19th century and is rooted in Native American traditions that use the oil from rattlesnakes as powerful medicine to help heal with rheumatism, arthritis, and other muscle and joint aches. Shamans shared recipe for balms and liniments from rattlesnakes oils with early settlers in the American West. Salesmen then got the idea to market the oils from Native Americans and started making all kinds of claims. Thus began the journey of snake oil salesmen. They traveled throughout the Southwest, peddling their wares in medicine shows and claiming healing for everything imaginable. How the oils got such a bad name doesn't lie in the oils themselves. The problem began when people exaggerated the oil's powers and made them into tools to deceive gullible people. As time went on, these snake oils contained less and less oils from snakes and more homeopathic tonics filled with ingredients like red pepper and camphor mixed with alcohol. You know, and then the alcohol increased tons during Prohibition. The latter having to do more with concoction's soothing effect than the former. Although most of the homeopathic essential oils necessary for healing were abandoned, these concoctions were still known as snake oil. The term is now used to refer to a worthless remedy, and a snake oil salesman is one more concerned with making a profit than helping people. I knew I needed to reclaim the title in a more positive light. After all, I had all the tools I needed to sell the promise of healing. I had a heart full of gratitude, a fair amount of brokenness, a healthy dose of skepticism, a hankering for entrepreneurship, and a big desire to help the underdog. All of those ingredients mixed with being a priest and an advocate for women on the streets created a recipe for changing lives. The comment I made was not meant to devalue the product's healing abilities, but instead, it was intended to offer freedom. The art of healing is a huge gift. It is the central sacrament of a community of faith, yet it is also one of the most abused aspects of the church. The oils we have are the finest medicine in history, and the qualities within the oils have potent healing properties that, combined with love and prayers, are a source for healing. Their antiviral, antibacterial, antifungal, and anti-infectious abilities make them valuable tools in the healing process. Thistle Farms products have become a means of selling hope and a cause. The products provide healing on many levels, both for those who create them and for those who use them. The products intersect naturally with snake oils because they're made from all natural ingredients. They're sold with the intent to heal, and they carry a larger hope with each product. Our products have evolved into a line that claims to heal the skin, soothe stress, bring women into homes, and heal the world weary spirits. I began my career wanting to be a pastor, separated from the busyness of the world. And my desire for justice led me to make concoctions that Thistle Farms sells on an open market. To me, learning about oils has been like stepping into an age-old truth and feeling like you're discovering something new. I've never held much stock in those who claim to be faith healers, but I love that I've become part of a faith community that is dedicated to helping people heal both physically and emotionally. And I find now that I have more in common with backwoods healers than suburban pastors. We can all claim to be healers on the journey. So that's a little bit of defining it and setting it out. And then the next question that people are asking as you talk about snake oils is, why? Where did it come from? What was your motivation? And so I set the book up part as memoir. The first part of the book is really a memoir. And I have three figures that are my first snake oil salesmen. I have my father, who was an Episcopal priest, who moved us all to Nashville, Tennessee in 1968 and then died that same 1968 in a car crash. A drunk driver killed him. And then I have two other figures. And are Mr. Price's kids here? There's Richard Price and Linda Price, the daughter-in-law. Okay, it's so good to see you guys after, what, 30-something years? Wow. And so I have two people that kind of represent the good and bad side of snake oil salesmen. And I'll read the first one is the bad snake oil salesman, and then the second one is the good snake oil salesman. So this is all set in 1969, summer. My dad's been dead, and I'm out in the grass looking for four-leaf clovers, trying to find some good luck, and I'm reflecting on maybe why, as an adult looking back, would I be out in the yard? And I describe these people. This man was a snake oil salesman in the worst sense of the phrase. He offered us venom that we bought like liquid gold. He sold us a mirage and preyed on my innocence. He represents the villain in the story of my childhood, the purveyor of concoctions made by people who gain power on the backs of suffering. He was an elder in the church that my father had worked at. The abuse I endured from him was confusing to me. He showed generosity and kindness to my family. Then when everyone was gone, he would hold me down or hold me in his lap. He was oily and so strong that he could hold me in any position so I couldn't move. I didn't know how to respond. In those moments, I felt as if concrete were being poured down the back of my throat. My body felt heavy and my mind would drift off. I remember the last time he abused me. Both our families drove out to the countryside. It was a happy day, and I was thrilled I was getting a chance to ride a horse. By the time I realized that he and I were alone in the barn, it was too late. My mom had just left from the far end of the stable toward the riding ring. He picked me up, carried me on his hip, and walked to the other end of the barn. I can still smell the stink of the horse stall. Thick straw and a few piles of manure coated the concrete floor. Once inside the stall, he closed the wooden door with the X pattern of the reinforcing timber. I was completely hidden. The pungent smell of dung and damp straw dulled all the other senses that wanted to overwhelm me. I stared at him with a blend of fear, anger, and hate. The details of that final scene of abuse, the scent and paralyzing fear, have remained vivid in my memory as colorful and detailed as an oil painting. I still don't know why he stopped abusing me after that day. Maybe I'd finally learned to keep away. Maybe the way I stared him down worked, or maybe I'd just gotten too big for him to pick up. Like many abused kids, I thought I had done something to trigger the abuse, and I would feel humiliated if anyone knew what I let him do to me. To this day, talking and writing about the abuse feels like a betrayal to his family and the community I came from. I still worry about who might get mad about me writing it all down. Yet telling the truth of abuse and sharing the story are essential parts of healing. The abuse taught me some valuable lessons, and I paid a high price for each one. One of the lessons was that I don't have to trust authority. I can move around it, I can disregard it, or I can even use it for my advantage. That gift has served me well in my work, except for my nervousness when dealing with church hierarchy. It's true. I hate that. For a long time, I didn't know how to engage authority without feeling strange and untrusting. I thought that working under authority was full of landmines and traps, and as soon as I was dumb enough to get slip up, I'd lose my legs. I had to trust my own authority and intuition and find my way. This lesson provided the strength to start the Magdalene community and work with a model of shared authority. This past year, a woman named Shauna came into Magdalene with the words "trust no one" tattooed on her chest. I thought about how sad and hard those words are to bear as a young woman. But lately I've been thinking that they can be a gift. She can read those words and remember that she can trust herself. When she can't trust anyone else, she can trust her own voice. It took me decades and experience of starting the Magdalene community to understand that if I wanted to serve and be part of a healing journey for others, I needed to get on with my own healing process. There would be stories at Magdalene and at Thistle Farms and incidents that would trigger memories, and it was hard to do the work. And so one day, after running into the man who abused me at a wedding ceremony where he tried to hug me as if everything was fine between us, I finally decided it was time to call his house. The other side of that. If Mr. Oily was the weed, the bad snake oil salesman, then Mr. Price was the sweet clover and the first good snake oil salesman I ever met. This neighbor worked his whole life for the government making road maps of Tennessee. He drove a shiny pickup trucks that he waxed on Saturdays in his driveway. Mr. Price taught me how to bait a hook at Percy Priest Lake in Nashville and told me there was a nest of baby copperheads in the bottom of the lake that once swarmed a young girl who jumped off a rope swing. That's true. You can just keep saying, yes, he would do stuff like that. I knew he was kidding, but the thought kept me in the boat and on my toes. He was a great father figure to me, keeping me safe and making me laugh. On my birthday, he would take me to O'Charlie's restaurant, and I ordered a sirloin steak with A1 sauce, the fanciest meal I can remember having as a child. This kind neighbor is the first person I think of when I think of purveyors of good snake oil, not the nasty snake oil salesman who sold bridges to people in the desert, but fun snake oil sellers who mix up crazy tonics with the hope you'd feel better with a bit of luck. Even to this day, Mr. Price is kind of a memory tonic I take when I need to feel grounded in love. Mr. Price specialized in homemade remedies. Anything he could find lying around was fair game. Whenever a bee or wasp stung me, Mr. Price wet tobacco and placed it over the sting. If I cut myself while playing, he used a cloth dipped in turpentine to cleanse the wound. For scrapes, he used handkerchiefs dipped in mysterious concoctions he kept in his basement. For stomach aches, he would hand you a peppermint. He made use of baking soda, apple cider vinegar, tobacco, witch hazel, paper, lard, anything else around the house. When I was growing up, Mr. Price seemed to have the ability to make just about anything better. Whether fixing a flat tire or spicing up a boring day, he'd whip out his pocket knife and began to carve a peach pit, and the world felt like a better place. He had a clothesline in his backyard, which he used as a place to grow grapes. In the fall, we'd crush them with our bare feet. Whenever I had the blues, he had an inappropriate joke that made me laugh. He took pride in me as if I were his own. And despite his tough exterior, he was one of the gentlest creatures God ever made. After school's most day, I walked down to Mr. Price's house and we'd sit. He let me take draws off the pipe he smoked. He didn't mind that I was 6 years old and a girl. He thought it showed strength of character that I could smoke and not cough. He'd pass the pipe, matter-of-factly, you shouldn't smoke. Yet he always offered, and I always accepted. The next thing people ask me is, what have you learned? What have you learned along the way? And so some of the chapters are dedicated to anything from fragrance to incantations to all these other things. And so this is a chapter on incantations. Developing rituals such as not wearing shoes, crossing yourself, kneeling, placing your palms together are reminders to take a healing posture. Rituals place us in a healing position. They alert us that we are setting aside a specific time and place for something special. Along with most of these physical rituals, words accompany the posture. The words are familiar phrases like incantations that conjure up the sacredness of the moment. Incantations are like calls to prayer, responses, and words repeated in liturgy. These sayings help center and move us into sacred space. I use the word incantation like I use the word snake oil. I take both of these old terms and peel back layers of culture meaning to rediscover and reconnect with very simple and earthy ideas of faith and healing. Prayers, mantras, and rhythms allow us to speak to where we are and what our intentions should be. Many incantations were introduced to us in childhood and have been repeated to us many times. As soon as the phrase is uttered, we know what is happening and what is coming. Far less religious incantations for children include Ali Ali Oxen Free, Abracadabra, Once Upon a Time, Long Ago and Far Away. None of my kids learn those incantations exactly. My oldest used to start every story with Long Away and Far Ago. My middle son used to say, Once a Bitty Time. And my youngest, when I would say, once upon a time, would yell, but I don't want to go to bed. The sentence incited begging to stay up a little bit longer. Even as adults, we know that when a friend says, you better not tell, what follows is not going to be good. I hate to bother you means a heavier workload will follow the conversation. You got to hear this means my husband or son has written a new melody, and I need to drop what I'm doing and listen. Our incantation in the daily Thistle Farm circle developed without any discussion or counsel. Over the course of years, as we welcomed new women every day from every station of life, we started by saying, welcome to the circle. And I don't, there's probably three or four people in here who have spent the last week with me in Ecuador. We go to the same place every year. It's a great place to learn about healing and homeopathic remedies and to be in community and to learn all the lessons. But it's also taught me a lot about all our assumptions about poverty and justice and how important that is in both healing and truth-telling. Nothing makes us question how love heals as much as seeing the injustices of poverty in this world. Poverty rattles the rules of love and troubles our souls. The effects of people suffering without enough food makes us wonder if healing is an outcome of love can permeate the hard skin of poverty. The economic troubles of my childhood probably made me more vulnerable to abuse. Poverty is what drives Thistle Farms to partner with other social enterprises that serve people suffering under its burden and the victims of sexual violence. It is so troubling to everything we think we know about healing and values when you see some of the devastating effects that having no resources will wreak on women's lives. We have four partnerships right now with Thistle Farms, and all three of them are in Africa. But the hardest one, the most challenging partnership, has been with our women's group in Ecuador. It's taken us years and years. And tonight, we finally have, and it's taken us a long time, our first product, which is the holder for all our healing oils. So the women's group has produced and made them, and so that we have all the beautiful healing oils that you're dying to buy. In one easy case, similar to the Bonnie Bell lip smackers from my youth. It really was the inspiration behind this. I love that so much. Did y'all, you don't have to admit it, but they were wonderful, the whole variety of Bonnie Bell lip smackers. Yes. Healing oil lip smackers, pretty much. So they're all roll-ons like that, but these have, this is Compassion, which has the geranium from Rwanda, and it has Contemplation, which has the oldest oils in it, which are, you know, the frankincense and myrrh that carry us to a great space for opening up. And the inspiration is the bergamot and cardamom and all those great fresh herbs that carry us into a place of joy. And then we have the ahimsa, which is named after the whole Gandhian idea of the soul force of the world. So we took the recipe that God gave Moses for healing oils up on Mount Sinai and turned it into one of our lip smackers. And the mitzvah, which are the acts of goodness and kindness. And this has beautiful ginger root in it. So this is the whole array. In each chapter of this book, we start with a recipe for you to make oils on your own. And that and the idea is that, you know, we have quit doing it. So it's awkward. It's awkward to pull out oils. And we need to, I think, in some ways, especially in the South, let the casserole go. You know, you really don't want that after surgery. This would be much better. So you should always have one of these in the back of your car when you go visit someone, and you can offer them the oils that really will be about their healing. So our most challenging partnership so far has been with the women's group in Ecuador. Even after 15 years of our returning annually to the same small town to run a clinic and help grow a small school, the women's cooperative is only now getting off the ground. It is so troubling to see the wealth and poverty yoked together in this country. Just off an old two-lane highway in Ecuador near the school and clinic, there are rich fields that sit in a valley of a cloud forest. The seeds scattered in this rich soil yield 100-fold 3 or 4 seasons a year. In those same fields, dirt-poor campesinos, farmers, and concrete shanties are well-rooted. We once traveled to a spot just down the road from the community to buy lemongrass and mint. The spot was just a gap in the road where skinny dogs with ribs you could count from a distance roamed, waiting for a crumb to be dropped by barefoot children. Behind the littered dirt yard, on the other side of a nearby hidden gate, there was an arbored path. While we waited for the gardener to pack up the plants we had purchased, a few of us became sidetracked and started wandering down the dreamy, fragrant path. The path was flanked by a beautiful orchard, heavy laden with mangoes and coca fruit. The orchard sloped downhill, littered with fruit trees for as far as you could see. As we continued walking, I kept thinking about how this path was the epitome of the disparity that tears the world apart. On this path, you could see the wealth of a vast orchard before harvest, and just down the road, you could see the poverty of children with scabies holding on to starving dogs. The image provided a dramatic illustration of the sickness of the world that lives in me. I feel the tension all the time as I decide to how I'm going to spend my money and where to lay my head. I was grateful for this side road that helped me look a little closer than just a quick drive along a two-lane highway. The fields of this world are troubled, and when we take the time to sit in them, they can't help but trouble our souls. The fields of Ecuador call me to rethink my ideas of justice, complacency, and ignorance. These aren't a distraction from my life in Nashville. They are some of the most powerful fields I have ever known. When I sit in that field and soak in the sunlight with all kinds of concoctions on my body to protect me from the mosquitoes and glaring sun, I remember that our world is both unjust and lovely. These trouble fields provide an opportunity to back up and remember what I believe about the truth of my life. Just go ahead and turn it off. No, I'm teasing. I'm a preacher, and it happens every single week of my life. My theory is that there will always be snake oil sellers with us, and that is a blessing, not a curse. As long as people are healed by stories and willing to pay for them, people will keep telling them. You know, they come from all over in all parts of the world. They're there in Africa, they're there in Asia, they're there in South America, they're here in Nashville. And I stumbled onto the path of snake oil seller accidentally, but I embrace it fully. One of the times I embraced it most closely was the time that we started making Thistle Farms products out of thistle, and I was out collecting thistles in a field. And I pulled over on the side of the road because I saw a half-dead field of thistle in the middle of January, which was like a gold mine for me. And so I got out of my car, and I had my Kroger's grocery sack, and I started picking the heads off all the thistle when a car slowed down. And a man looked at me, not in a scary way, but in a concerned way. And through his eyes, I saw myself. At that point, I was, you know, a 45-year-old woman. In the middle of the day, in the middle of the week, bent over picking a half-dead thistle. And I thought, really, I couldn't aim any lower in my life because I have become a thistle farmer. And I literally almost buckled on my knees when I realized the epiphany I was having. That all these side roads and all these wanderings and all this forgiveness I had known and all this brokenness and all this hope and all this longing had led me to stand right out there and not miss the beauty of a field of half-dead thistle. That I had named a company almost a decade earlier after a weed nobody cared about, and it had become life-saving for me, that the world could be my farm and I could go anywhere and harvest and see the riches of it, and there is nothing in this whole creation to be condemned. So I'm here to ask you to embrace that same thought of snake oil selling and thistle farming and all the things that people degrade, and see it as beautiful and wonderful as part of creation in the hope of healing this world. You are all healers. Sometimes we just have to remind each other that we have been born with everything we need to make this journey of healing. Our journeys began with God and they will end with God. So the journey in between is a journey towards healing. I hope this book helps you remember that. When we forget, it becomes awkward. It becomes awkward to touch other human beings. It becomes awkward to touch people in a healing and honest way, whether in words or in deeds, in any way. We need more good old-fashioned healers that aren't afraid to carry around some liquid that can illuminate the dark places and the places that carry the oldest scars in the world. Maybe sexual violence is one of the oldest scars this world has ever known. And maybe as more and more people claim that even healing from that is possible, we will be better. The truth is that I am selling a movement along with this book and these wonderful healing oils. I mean that. And I mean it when I say that Jericho and Parnassus and everyone else carries a lot of people along with them when they begin to help us. They carry around the whole world, and they root us, and they help grow this movement. And what it's a movement of, it's a movement of people who are not afraid to never give up, to not be Pollyannic, but be just doggedly determined to love and to watch love heal. People who are willing to remember that when you heal the women, you are healing a whole community. Just like when you rape the women, you kill the community. It's a movement of people who are not condoning the silence that has gone along with child sexual abuse, that is not willing to condone, even in their silence, a society that still buys and sells people as commodities. So what I'm asking for tonight is for you to be a part of that in any way you can. Definitely buy a book, obviously. Please, but maybe buy two. One for you and one for someone else. And to go out there, and you need to buy Thistle Farms products, not just for you, but we want them in public places. If you have an office, put a lotion or a soap in the bathroom. People read it there. And stamped on every bottle of our products is Love Heals. It seems crazy to think that we can love each other and somehow it will change the world. But it's crazier to think that the world is ever going to change if we don't love each other. Thank you. I think we have time for a few questions, if anybody has any. Is that right? I can't. Yes. We have. There's a microphone, if anybody. We're just going to take a few questions. There's the microphone.
I don't know anything about homeopathic.
I'm sorry?
I don't know anything about homeopathic medicines and all that. So what originated? How did the thistle come about?
Well, the thistle's been around a long time, so I'm going to give, this would just be a 3-minute thing. So basically, to make these healing oils, and Julie is really the expert on this, Julie Cantrell. But basically, you take a few essential oils and a few carrier oils, and you mix them together, and you can make your own. And this is all explained in the book. And so whatever the essential oil is, that's the essence of the plant. It literally runs through the plant. So to take, and I could, it's so hard to do this short. You can distill it, you can get it out of the plant however you want, but it's the small molecules and the healing elements. So things like, you know, things of the essence of the plants. Think of things like lavender, or think of lemongrass, or basic stuff you see around. There's an essence right in the plant, or geranium. And so you distill it out, and the liquid gold of the plant comes out, and it's been going all around through the plant. You can't just put that stuff on your body. It burns it. It's so beautifully powerful and healing. You just can't do it directly. So you have carrier oils. So the carrier oils are things that are in like seeds of the plant. They're on the outside of the plant. And you can just press it. And you think of things like olive oil, aloe vera oil, apricot oil, things that are in that part that are really gentle and moisturizing. So you take a little essential oil and a lot of carrier oil and you mix them together and you get a blend. And literally, if you looked at Exodus 30, the first recipe I ever learned is right there. Moses goes up Mount Sinai and he says, you take a little bit of cinnamon, you take a little bit of clove, you mix it with a lot of olive oil, and it will heal people for generations. And then the ADA comes back around, you know, whatever, 2,500 years later and says, y'all aren't going to believe this, but cinnamon is good for you. And however you can ingest it into your body, which is why the oils are so good. You're not eating them, but the carrier oils allow the absorption, and then the essential oils literally circulate through your body and are part of the healing process. Thistle is one example of one of the oils that you could distill out or use an extract from. And for about 1,000 years, people have used thistles both to regulate themselves after trauma, to restore and detoxify the liver. We just happened to name it Thistle Farms because we thought theologically it was really perfect that it was the one weed or wildflower left where the women were walking. Turns out it's exactly the one we needed for healing for people who have liver problems.
What's your writing process like in the midst of your schedule? How did you finish that book?
My writing process is... I'm thinking what it is. I write in the bathtub. I don't want to say that, but that's my writing process. I write in the bathtub. And I have a little shelf, and I have a side shelf. And I get up in the morning and I write, and I go out in the woods and I take notes and I write, and I'm on the road and I write, and then I put it all together in some kind of form. And I have friends like Allie and Carol Hagen that are great editors, and Tim and Susan, and people help me. I have a lot of help, but I would say that I'm writing all the time. I'm writing right now about y'all. No, but I feel like that. Don't you feel like that when you're out in the world? I mean, I used to think, like, you know, you might get sick of preaching. Like, what else would you have to say? How could you write a sermon? And if you're paying attention, there's a million. There's so much. And it's a matter of paying attention enough to have the thought and then writing it down and jotting it down and then working it out. For me, I have to work it out later, and I need help working it out. I'm writing a book now. I'm moving, and I found that it's getting easier, not harder, to do the actual writing piece of it. I think it's like everything. If you do it enough, it starts coming better than it used to come. It used to be like, you know, I could get a sentence out. Now I can get, you know, I have some ish focus issues. I can get like a couple pages at a time. Anything else?
I know that you're an Episcopal priest, and I was curious why you don't wear the collar and why you generally go just by Becca instead of Reverend Becca Stevens. Oh, the face.
No, those are good questions. Why? I think it's because there's a lot of different reasons. I think some places collars are helpful, and I think other places collars aren't helpful. I got ordained when I was 8.5 months pregnant with my first child, and so I didn't wear a collar. And I didn't wear a collar while I was nursing him. And I didn't wear shoes. And I never put shoes back on when I was preaching. And I think some of that stuff felt like it was my dad's outfit, really. And I knew I wasn't going to be able to wear those shoes, literally. And I do better without it. If you see me in a collar, something bad's happened. I don't know if Becky Eagle's here, but when I came to visit them in the hospital and I had my collar on, I mean, she started crying right when I walked in. And I was like, I know. But I mean, you know, I will put it on, but I have to find it. And then, you know, and then I go by Becca because, what was the question? What was it? I do sometimes. Sometimes I would. I don't know that as an author I would want that as part of it. I don't know. Plus it's like I'm scared of some of that stuff. I'm scared of some of the trappings of all that institutional stuff for me. I think it works great for other people. For me, it does not work that well. I do better, you know, out in the field and as a chaplain, and, you know, I do better that way. Why? In my mind, I had carried it around. She's asking me, why did I go back to the abuser? And that story is all in here. And you'll probably need to buy the book. I'm just teasing. I'm teasing. No, I'll tell you, hell. For me, I had carried it around for so long, and my son was getting ready to start kindergarten when all that stuff had happened to me, and I was literally not functioning well. I was getting hives. That was the outward invisible sign of the inward and spiritual stress that I didn't want him to go to school. And so I thought, I'll just give this back to him and let him take that from here. And so I called he and his wife, and they didn't really know why I was calling, and I just said I needed to come over, put on my collar. And I did. And I went over to their house, and it was really awkward. And the crazy thing was, is he admitted everything. And I was like, you know, I really couldn't believe it. And I had talked to Alice Randall about it and some other friends, and I'd gotten a plan together. And I knew I didn't want anybody to go with me, and I knew I wanted to do it with both of them. I wanted his wife to know because they had kids. And I thought that was really important. And anyway, it is a long story, but I did. I was like, I have carried this around for so long. I'm so tired of it. And I'm done with it. I want him to go like, now it's yours. And his first question was, who have you told? And I was like, I got some bad news. You know, and it was hard for especially his wife. It was hard. And, you know, and I feel like I probably helped some people along in their family, too. One of the things he had said was the reason it happened, I was so special, I was like a daughter to him. And it was like, well, that is, you know, that's so scary. So anyway, that was why. Mm-hmm. She wants you to have the microphone.
I'm just wondering what you imagine, or actually what you hope for Thistle Farms and Magdalen 10 years from now. Like, what do you imagine? Because it's blowing up and it's really amazing, and I'm just wondering.
Yeah, and it's not blowing up as big as you might think. We need help blowing it up. We need help. I mean, seriously, that's why we really believe it's a movement. We really, really need everybody to help. Carol Hagen is the person that organizes all the events and the home parties, and we need that to keep going so much. But I've never, ever, ever had a 10-year plan, but I can tell you where we're headed. And where we're headed is we're having our first national conference here in Nashville, Tennessee on October 13th. We've been having these education days. You know that there's 2.5 million people in prison, 7.5 million if you count everybody on probation, longer and longer sentences for drugs, that most of the women that are incarcerated definitely have a history of sexual abuse as kids and trauma in childhood. poverty issues, you know, the addiction comes on the heels of all of that stuff. Y'all can say amen anytime you want to. And we have, with those kinds of numbers, hundreds of long-term free beds in the United States of America for women. So if anybody thinks anybody went to the streets by themselves, they're crazy. And if anybody thinks that women just come off the streets by themselves, you know, that's impossible too. It takes the whole community to bring people together. It takes a long time. It's a climb and fall and climb and fall and then keep going and keep going. It is a humbling thing to heal. So it's a good model that we have. If you, in the country, it's a good model. So we have about we have a monthly immersion day every month at Thistle Farms. You're all welcome to come and be a part of it. And you learn all about the model and all about what Thistle Farms is. And last month we had 35 people, 8 different states, from California to Virginia to Florida, Texas, I can't remember everywhere. And people are really hungry for what this model is. So instead of just doing these smaller immersion days, we're going to do a whole conference of welcome to the circle and to really try to welcome people in a bigger way. So Eden House has opened in New Orleans. We're not trying to franchise. We're trying to have sister communities. We're going to launch a shared trade initiative. So all these small social enterprises that we're partnering with, we can have a federation or alliance, and that we can do direct trade, which is much fairer, and build a larger website in that area. So my hope is where we're headed is a lot of smaller communities. Smaller communities, most powerful way to heal in the whole world. You know, community is the place where we hold each other accountable, hold each other up. The sum is greater than the parts, all of those things. And what we need to do on Thistle Farm sales is really blow it up in the next year. Or, you know, it's tricky. It's tricky to... you know, our numbers are good. We sell about $700,000 a year in products, but we need to be up over $1 million by this next year, or we're gonna, you know, and it's gotta be, for us, our best margins are internet sales. So we're really trying to learn what social media means for us, and how do you translate people liking you, which you should all do. How do you translate that into actual sales? We have not gotten there. And if you have any ideas, let's do one more question and stop.
I was curious about, you work with women all, you know, in your daytime and in your mission, and you raise 3 sons, and as a mother of a son, I'm curious, what do you teach your sons about the work you do, or how do you hope that's going to impact them in their adult male lives?
It's a good question. They're all good questions. I don't mean just yours, all of them. What am I teaching my sons? Oh my gosh, I hope. You know, my sons are with me at Thistle Farms. They've worked in the summer there. They've been there. I mean, everybody knows my kids. I hope that, you worked with them all through. I made them work all the way through Christmas and New Year's this year, putting in a floor for the new sewing studio with Ken. I hope I'm teaching them to be for the underdog. And I hope I'm teaching them, that is, loving people is the most important work that you're ever going to do, period. And that I hope I'm teaching them that you better respect every single person or you're going to be in time out. You know, and that it doesn't matter if people come from, you know, the streets, or they come from Yale, or they come from, you know, wherever in between those places are, it makes no difference, period, ever. What matters is, you know, I mean, our morality is based on how do we treat other human beings and do it in a loving way that changes us. Thank you all so much. I'm so grateful. Thank you.